Hello and welcome to the Controversies in Church History podcast. My name is Derek Taylor, your host for this podcast. This is a reminder that you can find Controversies in Church History on various social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and also on Patreon. If you'd like to become a patron of the podcast, this is a free podcast for most people. I try to make it available through as many platforms and different types of social media as I can, but I do actually try to advertise every once in a while. I do have a few expenses for doing this, and it is a lot of work. So this is supposed to be a service. You're not supposed to actually, you don't have to do this, but if you'd like to become a patron of our podcast, go to patreon.com and you'll find our Patreon page on Patreon, where you can become a donor, a monthly donor. I think it's $5, $7, and $10 to help out defray some of the cost of this stuff. Going forward, I'm going to start doing more things, interviews of those sorts of nature for patrons on Patreon, to focus more on that. So if you want to keep supporting the podcast, keep it going. All the episodes in terms of the archive of what I've done will be available free. Eventually they'll be made after a month or so, all the new ones, but if you become a patron, you get new episodes a month in advance. You get some other things, bonus features that it won't make available. All the regular episodes will be available to all people. So just to help out and say thank you to some of my donors. So if you'd like to do that, please go to patreon.com and think about signing up. Thank you and God bless. Hello and welcome to Controversies in Church History. My name is Derek Taylor, the host for this podcast, which takes you through the most interesting, important, and controversial episodes in the history of the Roman Catholic Church. Welcome once again to all my listeners out there. As a reminder, you can find Controversies in Church History on the web at churchcontroversies.com, website for this podcast. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on YouTube, Twitter. We're hosted by Spotify for podcasters, I should say. You can find links to all that on the website at churchcontroversies.com. And special thanks to all the patrons of the podcast on Patreon. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, you can go there, add a small donation every month, you know, $5 a month or whatever, if you'd like to. Big thing we ask of you is to spread the word about the podcast, let me know about my work if you think it's important. It helps keep me going, by the way, to hear feedback and encouragement from you. So appreciate that more than anything. So welcome to the latest episode of Controversies in Church History. And this is the latest episode, episode 9 of my ongoing series on the Latinization of the Eastern Catholic Churches, those episodes in its history, in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, where Rome or its missionaries or its other agents Latinize Eastern Catholic churches with different traditions in communion with it, and either through, you know, pressure or through sometimes voluntarily, as we've seen, they adopt Latin customs because that's been a controversial aspect of the Catholic Church and its relationship with churches, those Eastern Catholic Eastern churches, I should say, the Orthodox churches outside of its communion. So in this episode, I'm going to step back. The last time I've divvied up the series by conventional historical divisions, you know, medieval, early modern. Now we're into the modern era. I did one episode on the Ruthenian Catholics in America last time, because I've been promising it to one of my listeners. But I want to step back here and give you a broad overview and talk about specifically some of the background for the whole of the Western Church, but specifically in this episode, calling it the Papacy and the Eastern Churches, 1846 to 1958, basically covering the pontificates of Pius IX through Pius XII, just on the eve of the Second Vatican Council, to give you the broad sweep of things beyond the relationship of Rome with its Eastern Catholic churches, what is influencing Rome's policy toward these Eastern churches, and talk about a couple of major changes that occur in this period, because this is a turning point in some ways, the modern era. And so let's begin. And the major event, of course, that shapes Rome's attitude toward, well, everything in the modern era, of course, is the French Revolution, the revolution and the wars up to 1815, Napoleon reshape Europe. They cause an upheaval, untold upheaval. They unleash the forces of nationalism such that even though after 1815 they tried to restore throne and altar arrangements in Europe, they're shaken by revolutions by 1848 pretty much in every major European country.
and of course in the Papal States, which are restored after after the wars in 1814. Briefly, the Pope Pius IX is briefly dislodged in 1848 by a revolution there. And particularly the unleashing of nationalist movements target the church across Europe. Its prerogatives, its privileges, they get rid of them over the course of the 19th century in many countries, its control of education. But particularly in two countries, in Italy, where the Risorgimento leads to the unification of Italy, first in 1861, then in 1870, where they swallow up the Papal States, make Rome its capital, and then the German unification movement, which ends in 1870 with the defeat of with Prussia defeating France in a war and then unifying Germany behind it, leads to conflict with the church. So you have this as the primary political battle it's fighting in the 19th century, shapes a lot of it. I've talked about this in other venues and some of my writings for 1 Peter 5 and Crisis Magazine, but it really spooks the Vatican. They think the world's coming to an end, and it leads to the sense that the Vatican needs to reassert its, the church needs to reassert its authority and rally around the Pope to do that. We'll come back to that in a second. Second major historical event or process that influences, especially the Catholic Church's relationship with the Eastern Catholic Churches, the Roman Church's relationship with its Eastern Catholic Churches in communion with it, is European colonialism. Because in the 19th century, we have a sort of second wave of European colonialism, especially after 1850, but even before that, in which Western powers carve up large parts of the territories of Africa and Asia. And for our purposes, the areas of the Middle East, mostly the Ottoman Empire, and Asia, mostly India, will directly affect, most directly affect the Eastern Catholic Churches and its relationship with Rome. We'll get to the specifics of those relationships in future episodes. And then finally, just sort of more directly internal affairs. I mentioned the restoration of the Papal States and the papacy for the better part of several decades, trying to keep a hold of them, tended to occupy its time. The restoration of the Jesuits in 1814. Remember, they were abolished in the 1770s, and Pius VII brings them back the year he's restored to the Papal States. There's also, of course, a wider war against, well, you call it a war against liberalism, that they're fighting in the church in terms of internal affairs. There's the growth of a Catholic liberal movement with the Abbé de Lamennais at its head, the great Lamennais. I've written about this actually for Crisis Magazine, but you can consult my podcast series, the episodes on Catholic liberalism about this, but that occupied several decades of its life and sharpens its focus. It's thinking in anti-modern terms and wanting the papacy is wanting to reassert its authority over the entire church, which leads us into, you know, how that will deal with the Eastern Catholic churches. The big thing, of course, is that especially with the reign of Pius IX, he becomes convinced that all of society is falling apart. It needs the reassertion of the church's authority, and in particular, Rome's authority. And this will lead to, well, two things. One, this happens before Pius IX gets into the throne of Peter, but there's a drive to centralize more and more power in the Pope's hands. And this is, by the way, something that's pushed for. It's popular, actually, in Western Europe. Again, things are changing rapidly. The state is, you know, in some ways assaulting the church, seizing its properties, you know, turning monks and, you know, nuns out of convents and forcing them to become laymen and stuff like this. And so there's a desire in a lot of places for the Pope's authority to be strengthened. And so there's a drive to centralize a lot of things in Rome's hands. And again, this has been happening anyway, going back to the Reformation of the Council of Trent, but it ramps into overdrive in the 19th century, where the Vatican wants more and more oversight of, well, kind of everything, and that will include the Eastern Catholic Churches. And this will be, as you'll see, this will be, as you can see, as we'll talk about for a moment, this does play into Latinization. It's probably partly behind some of what's happens with the Ruthenian Catholics in America. As I'll try to argue, though, I think in the long run, it actually does work to its benefit. And we'll talk about, you can even see this in this pre-Vatican II period here. And finally, what happens is, as a result of this need to reassert its authority, you're going to have you know, what I could call changes in latitudes, changes in attitudes on the part of the papacy. They will take a renewed interest in the Eastern Catholic churches and the churches, Eastern churches outside of its communion in a way they haven't since the Council of Florence. However, no real changes in ecclesiology. This is the thing that doesn't change. They still mostly see the Eastern Catholic churches in communion with Rome, communion with her, does Rome, as wonderful ancient witnesses to the faith of the whole church, which in practice means Rome's governance of the whole church. They see them as people with rights, but not necessarily as local churches who govern themselves in their own right in communion with Rome. And that would be the big change that happens after with Vatican II. But serious changes that I think are linked with the ones that happen later on, actually. So let's get through this and start. And we start with the, as I mentioned before, the pontificate of Pius IX. Many things you can say about Pius IX I have said elsewhere. He becomes Pope in 1846. There's some expectation he's going to be a liberal pope by people in Western Europe. It does not turn out that way. It was never true. But he is very keen to assert the authority of the papacy. And he takes an interest, a serious one, a sincere one, in the Eastern churches. And he famously issues an encyclical in 1848, In Suprema Petra Apostoli Sede, which, as you can see, has to do with the See of Peter, the Seat of Peter, addressed to the Eastern Catholic churches, in which he will reiterate the efforts of popes throughout the centuries to maintain the rights of the Eastern Catholic churches and their purity, which, of course, you've followed this series long enough, you know, they've always done that, and in principle had the popes, and in practice mostly, they have some slip-ups here and there. That's true. But he also talks about his efforts on their behalf in the Ottoman Empire. He talks about an embassy he sends to the Ottoman Emperor in Istanbul, and particularly in regard to the Armenian Catholics there. We'll talk about that in a later episode, but he is deadly serious, trust me, about this, is Pius IX. Very serious guy. I'd say, in a lot of the things Pius IX did, never questioned his sincerity or his love for Christ. His wisdom is another matter. And I say that because in the second half of this letter, In Suprema Petra Apostoli Sede, 1848, he makes an appeal to those Eastern churches outside of communion with Rome. And basically, he will basically say, yes, you should come back into communion with Rome, otherwise you are outside and therefore schismatics and heretics for denying the authority of Rome. He basically reiterates the standard polemics that have existed for centuries, but with, I think, sincerity, really wants them to come back in. And this is important. Father Aidan Nichols wrote a book years ago, a fine Dominican priest, called Roman and Eastern Churches. And this signals a sort of seriousness and urgency with regards to the Eastern Churches and reunion that really has not been seen since the Council of Florence. And it's real. But it's also really, really, really tactless. I mean, really tactless in the way he does it. I admit reading through this was a little bit cringy. Although I must say I felt better when I read the Orthodox response to it, which there is a response to it, because it's also kind of cringy. Again, I'm a traditionalist, but I guess I'm a post-Vatican II traditionalist, in which four Eastern patriarchs, the Patriarch of Constantinople, Alexandria, Patriarchs of Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, all along with the synods of each of these patriarchs, issue a response which responds in kind. Basically says, yes, you're the schismatics and the heretics. Rome has been just falling into heresy ever since the 11th century. And I won't belabor all this. And I don't mean to denigrate, again, the Orthodox at all or Pius IX. I'm just saying that there are problems I would have with both. But the way that Pius IX did this was so tactless. He didn't even actually send the encyclical to these actual patriarchs. He sent it to the faithful. They printed thousands of copies and distributed them free to just Orthodox in their patriarchates. This is a really, really bad way of doing this. Nonetheless, by the way, he persisted in this, less so with the reunion aspect of it. The people around him were more optimistic. I don't know why, given their attitudes, but for the rest of his pontificate, as you'll see, he made strenuous efforts to reach out to the Eastern Catholic churches, and even though, again, his hopes for reunion kind of fizzled after he saw the attitudes of the Orthodox patriarchs, but very sincere. Although, as you'll see, within a certain framework of both the traditional claims of Roman, jurisdiction, but also in terms of this, drive to centralize things because they thought it was a necessity given the what they took to be the state of the world at that time. The other thing, of course, the major, there are other things I'll come to in a moment, but the other major sort of initiative that Pius IX undertakes, of course, is that he calls for an ecumenical council and invites the Eastern Catholic prelates to Vatican I, where they make up part of the minority that was in opposition to the definition of papal infallibility and primacy represented by the dogmatic constitution Pastor Eternus. And they were concerned both with the integrity of their own traditions, which, as you'll see in a moment, they had reason to be concerned about, but also they were concerned about ecumenical relations with the Orthodox. And one of the reasons they were concerned is because under Pius IX, you do have this drive to push for greater and greater uniformity. And this will take in practical terms, a form of Latinization. One historian I consulted for this, named Father Ferrugia, was a Jesuit, talked about how basically, for example, he mentions a prelate who's made a patriarch, a Latin patriarch, which I'll get to in a moment, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem by Pius IX. One of his recommendations was that he was basically trying to sort of move the Eastern Christians in that area toward Latin customs. Again, there was this sense that, yeah, they needed to be, there's still this sense that to be real Catholics, they had to sort of adopt Latin customs. And you can kind of see this in some of this in the unwillingness of some Eastern patriarchs, by the way, Eastern Catholic patriarchs, to declare their support for Pastor Eternus. I won't belabor this in too much detail, in some of Pius IX's own apostolic letters and encyclicals, he writes about how certain Eastern Catholic patriarchs, we'll talk about this more next time, they take a long while to declare their support for Pastor Eternus. They have problems with it. And so this seems like an imposition on their customs and traditions. And so there's tensions over this, even though, as we'll see, I still think Pius IX was fairly, whatever you can say about him, sincere in trying to reach out and deal with their needs. His successor, of course, Leo XIII, is more famous and probably more well-known for reaching out to the Eastern churches in terms of official documents, official communications. He issued two major apostolic letters. In 1894, he becomes Pope in 1878. In particular with his apostolic letter, Praeclara, Gratulationis Publicae. He addresses to all Christians, basically making appeal for all Christians to return to communion with Rome. And of course, in particular, he has a series of passages addressed to the Orthodox churches. And Leo is a lot more tactful than Pius IX. He's a lot more, he's more appreciative. I think he knows more about, probably, the Eastern traditions than Pius IX does, but makes the appeal ultimately in the similar terms to what Pius IX said. Basically, it's an ecumenism of return. It's something what they call this after Vatican II, usually disparagingly, about attempts to try to promote reunion by basically saying, repent and submit to Rome, or, return with a V, that's basically what this is. And once again, the Orthodox are not biting this. 1895, another encyclical, this time by the Patriarch of Constantinople, along with some of his bishops, issue another reply to Leo XIII, reiterating mostly the same polemical points. It's Rome that's really in schism. They've departed from apostolic tradition. I won't belabor these things at this moment. But these two replies, by the way, in 1848 and 1895 by the Orthodox, are to this day the most authoritative statements about the papacy on record. Particularly the first one, the one in 1848 has four patriarchs, so it's, again, as authoritative as you can get without an actual, you know, Orthodox council meeting and deciding on this stuff. The second apostolic letter, maybe more important and more directly dealing with the Eastern Catholic churches, in 1894, is the letter Orientalis Dignitas by Leo XIII. And it's important for a couple of reasons. One is it marks a real shift in attitudes toward the Eastern Catholic churches. It's meant to augment the place of the Eastern churches in communion with Rome. It explicitly, and in very glowing terms, I'll read some of this stuff to you in a moment, recognizes the not only the legitimacy of the rights of the Eastern Catholic churches, but their value to the church as a whole in a way it really hasn't before. And then, more to the point, it actually issues prohibitions against Latinizing among missionaries and other clergy of the Latin Rite in Eastern Catholic territories. And so, in that sense, it marks a turning point. Let me read you some of the language here. I'll read you something from Pius IX in a moment to give you a sense of this. Read some of it here. Paragraph or two. This is Orientalium Dignitas. Pope Leo XIII, 1894, the churches of the East are worthy of the glory and reverence they hold throughout the whole of Christendom in virtue of those extremely ancient, singular memorials that they have bequeathed to us. For it was in that part of the world that the first actions for the redemption of the human race began in accord with the all-kind plan of God. They swiftly gave forth their yield, their flowered in first blush the glories of preaching the true faith of the nations, of martyrdom and of holiness. They gave us the first joys of the fruits of salvation. From them has come a wondrously grand and powerful flood of benefits upon the other peoples of the world, no matter how far flung. When blessed Peter, the Prince of Apostles, intended to cast down the manifold wickedness of error and vice in accord with the will of heaven, he brought the light of divine truth, the gospel of peace, freedom in Christ, to the metropolis of the Gentiles. Going on, next paragraph. It has been most especially the habit of the Roman Church, the head of all the churches, to render to the churches of the East a great degree of honor and love and remembrance of the apostles, to rejoice in her turn in their faithful obedience. Amidst changing and difficult times, she has never failed in any way in farsightedness and acts of kindness to sustain them against the forces that would strike them again and again, to hold fast those that were overwhelmed, to call back those in discord with her. Nor was it the last expression of her watchfulness that she guard and preserve them in whole and entire forever, the customs and distinct forms for administering the sacraments that she had declared legitimate in her wise jurisdiction. He goes on to quote examples of what's been done in the past, Pius IX, other predecessors, what he's done. And by the way, we'll get to this in a moment. He does a lot for the Eastern Catholic churches. But he goes on to say this. He talks about wanting to lead talking about some of the plans for the Eastern Catholic churches and trying to reconcile Eastern Christians outside of the faith. I'll go on here. He says, quote, "Our goal is to discharge to the utmost degree whatever may be hoped for from the prudent direction of the Apostolic See. The reasons for rivalry and suspicion must be removed," he means among the Orthodox. "Then the fullest energies can be marshaled for reconciliation. We consider this of paramount importance to preserving the integrity proper to the discipline of the Eastern churches." And he goes on to say, he talks about instructing, you know, students in their own traditions and stuff like this, and forming clerics in their traditions, and says something very lovely here. He says, "In them the students, quote, in them the students will cultivate their rites with the greatest devotion, observe them, and have full knowledge of their usages. In point of fact, there is more importance than can be believed in preserving the Eastern rites. Their antiquity is august. It is what gives nobility to the different rites. It is a brilliant jewel for the whole church. It confirms the God-given unity of the Catholic faith." Unquote. Very beautiful, very, very impressive, again, from a point of view of things that have been said in the past by Rome about the Eastern Catholic churches. I won't belabor it. I might read the whole thing to you, but it's worth taking a look at. He does go on, down on to list a series of practical matters. I'll go through them here. He talks about extending, by the way. Does two things. One, he grants the Melkite patriarch in the Ottoman Empire jurisdiction over all his faithful within the Ottoman Empire. Then he goes on to list a series of things that had actually been granted to the Melkites in particular by Benedict the 14th in the 18th century and extends them to the whole of the church. Basically, the first thing he says is any Latin Rite missionary that tries to basically Latinize or get Eastern Rite faithful to come over to the Latin Rite will be, quote, deposed and excluded from his benefice in addition to ipso facto suspension ad divinis and other punishments, yada, 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 et cetera, et cetera. Just a various series of provisions to prevent that sort of thing from happening. I won't belabor this stuff, but just a very detailed list of things that should help out. And again, he universalizes this, so no one can doubt Leo XIII's sincerity. However, just to point, I'm trying not to be critical too much of the papacy or the Roman Church. I'm a Roman Catholic. So, but I do have to point out, they still have this problem. They really can't see the idea of reunion with the Eastern churches outside of its communion as anything but either or principle. I give you the best example I can give you this from the same encyclical, Orientalium Dignitas. Is this, he talks about the apostolic origin of these churches, and well, I'll read it to you because it's worth it. Basically, what he's saying in this passage is the real value of that. One of the great values of this is it shows how, you know, real unity comes with being unified with the Roman Church. Let me read this. He says, quote, for that very reason, even as her apostolic origin, he means the Roman Church, is all the more proven, especially by these churches of the East. At the selfsame moment, there shines out and is made manifest these churches' original, complete unity with the Roman Church. Nothing else, perhaps, is so breathtakingly effective for illustrating the mark of Catholicity in God's Church than that striking sight of different forms of ceremonies and noble examples of the tongues of the ancient past, all made all the more noble by their use by the apostles and fathers, rendering their submission to the Church. This is almost an image of that most excellent submission that was rendered to the newly born Christ, the divine founder of the church, when the Magi were drawn from the different regions of the East and came to adore him. I love Leo XIII. He was great, and he did a lot of good things. But comparing the Eastern Catholic churches and the Orthodox to a bunch of pagans who came to worship Christ is not the best look. and again, it gives you the problem here is that Rome, because it is the, you know, and again, I believe this, because it is the universal head of the universal church, it tends to identify its own, like, institutions as being the church by itself. It has a hard time seeing, you know, the Church of Constantinople or the Church of Antioch as being churches in their own right, local churches that have some meaningful existence distinct from Rome. And looking back, it seems painfully obvious, but you can see why there's still that fly in the ointment, even though this is a major change. And again, I think for the benefit of the Eastern Catholic churches. All right, so last thing to talk about in this relatively more brief episode. So you see some of the attitudes changing with Leo XIII. And so remainder of this I'm going to talk about because we have some changes of attitude going on here. And it's not just changes of attitude, by the way. They take a greater interest in, and I'll show you in a moment, they'll erect more institutions where, I want to say really for the first time, but for the first time as an institution, the Church of Rome begins to, well, take an actual interest in the actual beliefs and practices of the Eastern Catholic churches, meaning there's an institutional desire to learn more. I think for the first time, at least sustained over the course of several pontificates. And let me get to what I mean in a second. Let me explain myself. What I mean to say is that, you know, in the past you'd have certain, you know, popes here and there, Benedict the 14th come to mind, who were very interested in the Eastern Rites, and they would take time to learn things, but it didn't transfer over to the next, you know, pontificate because there wasn't a lot of institutional continuity there. And yes, even though the centralization of everything in the Vatican in the 19th century, I think was bad in the long run, definitely for the Latin Church and maybe for the Universal Church as a whole, I think in the long run it was good for the Eastern churches because it gave them an institutional presence they had hadn't had before, which meant there was, as you'll see, greater continuity of policy over time with their regards. Again, not always a good thing, as we'll see, but I think in the long run a good thing. And so let me just give you some examples of this, the centralization. Starting with Pius IX, I mentioned this earlier. One of the first things he does, actually, as Pope in 1847, is reestablish a resident Latin patriarch in Jerusalem. And what I mean by that, if you remember in the Crusades, the Latin patriarch basically drove out the Orthodox patriarch in Jerusalem. But when the last Crusader kingdom falls in 1291, the Orthodox patriarch comes back, and the Latin patriarch has to flee to Cyprus, where he remains until 1374, when I think the Venetians drive him out of there, and he has to go back to Rome. And so there's no longer, there's a titular Latin patriarch in Rome. But in 1847, one of the first things Pius IX, is actually restore a resident Latin patriarch in Jerusalem. However, it's with the express purpose, according to Father Ferrugia, who I mentioned earlier, of monitoring the other Eastern patriarchs, Eastern Catholic patriarchs. And I'll talk about what I mean by monitoring in a second. But he was very serious about this. Again, Pius in 1862 will establish a special section of the Congregation Propaganda Fide, the missionary congregation that was established in 1622. We talked about this on a couple episodes ago. Which up until then had responsibility for the Eastern Catholic churches. He establishes a special section to deal with them within the Propaganda Fide in 1862. That same year, he also issues an encyclical, Amantissimus Humani, which is addressed to the Eastern churches, on the care of the Eastern churches, in which he mentions, among other things, well, he talks about what they have all talked about, basically about what they have done, about, Roman authority, but also, again, how over time, things that he's done for the Eastern Catholic churches, things he's doing with, he talks about his establishment of a special department within the Propaganda Fide. But he also enjoins upon this congregation and the Eastern Catholic bishops to start, doing things like sending reports to Rome, to give him more knowledge about the state of the church there. I'll read a couple of paragraphs here. He says, quote, "It will greatly comfort us greatly if each of you venerable brothers, in assiduously reporting all the affairs of your respective diocese, will indicate the number of the faithful in the diocese, the number of ecclesiastics who minister to the faithful, the procedure for attending to the same faithful, not only in regard to faith, but also to the discipline of morals, the doctrine with which the clergy is instructed, the education of the clergy, the means and method of instructing the people in our most holy religion and its moral and immoral integrity, the plan whereby the same people are inspired and daily educated into greater piety and moral integrity. We also desire to know exactly the condition of your schools and how many youth customarily attend them. Since, venerable brothers, you well know that all hope of both sacred and public affairs depends on the right, salutary, and religious education of children. It is a particular concern that from their tender years they attend Catholic schools, where diligently learning the truth of our religion and commandments, they will escape the danger of having their sensitive minds tainted with evil principles," unquote. And again, by the way, when I said that stuff about Rome's wider concerns in Western Europe, one of their big concerns, of course, I mentioned it, is secular states are basically stripping education away from a lot of these places. And it's almost like they're making up for it by founding. And by the way, I'm criticizing Pius IX for centralizing a lot of things, and he's being very... again, this is a almost sort of paternalistic oversight of these Eastern Catholic churches. You know, we want all this information. And you can say there is a benign intention here. He wants to help them. I'll get that in a second. But it is wanting to have more control. But he is thinking, I'm certain he's thinking about the actual situation in Europe at the time, Western Europe. And in fact, in point of fact, as we'll get to in a moment, Rome actually does establish a lot of schools, seminaries for Eastern Catholic churches in the 19th and 20th centuries, does a lot of good work for them, and not just Rome, but other religious orders, congregations, especially in places like the Middle East, they do good work. So let me not, I'm not trying to make this sound totally, it's not totally sinister, it's just done in a certain way still, but with sincere, I think, concern. This is the next paragraph of Amantissimus Humani. Pius IX goes on, next paragraph following the one I just read, quote, if you need books, do not hesitate to make it known, and at the same time inform us of the books you consider most appropriate to provide dogma for the clergy, promote the education of the people, refute the teachings of those who are not Catholic, and foster the piety of the faithful. Most importantly, when we hear from you, and in some places liturgical and ritual books are being used, into which either some error has crept or a change has been arbitrarily introduced, it will be your duty to mention which books these are, and if at any time they have been approved by the Holy See. Specify too if in your judgment they contain errors to be corrected or abuses to be abolished. All that stuff there about liturgy is again an ancient concern with Rome. Going back to the Middle Ages, they've considered, again, they're guardians of the faith. That's why they've been, you know, treated at times certain Eastern rites as being suspicious. But again, you do see, I think, the genuine concern on part of the Pius IX. Again, I don't want to make it sound too bad, but it is a matter of increasing, you know, oversight and control of the Eastern Catholic churches, which you see even more is even more in evidence in his bull, papal bull. They don't make papal bulls anymore. They should bring back bulls. It sounds cool. Anyway, but he issued a bull in 1867. Called Reversurus, R-E-V-E-R-S-U-R-U-S, which basically took control of the election of, I think, bishops and patriarchs away from the Eastern Catholic churches, against which they protested roundly, I might add. And again, why does he do this? Well, he's doing the same thing in Western Europe. Again, they're concerned about, you know, the unity of the church in Western. And by the way, there still are cathedral chapters in Latin cathedrals, Western cathedrals in Europe, where they still elect bishops. Now the Pope has to give his approval, but they still have the right to elect their clergy. There used to be a lot more of them. Pius the Ninth put an end to a lot of them because he's centralizing things, and he did this also with the East. They didn't like it, as you will see in another episode. It caused a minor schism among one of the things that led to a schism among the Armenian Catholics. And so, okay, that's centralization under Pius IX. What about Leo XIII? A bunch of things. And again, some ways good things for the Eastern Catholics. 1886, Leo XIII erected dioceses for the Syro-Malabar Church in India. And we'll do another episode on them. Remember the tragedy of the splitting of the Thomas Christians? Well, those still in communion with Rome get their own bishops and own dioceses for the first time, 1886. Almost 10 years later, in 1895, another apostolic letter, Christi Domini, Leo XIII will erect a patriarchate for the Coptic Catholics in Egypt. Remember, there had been some for a while, 18th century, tried to get a patriarch there, the Sultan wouldn't let him in, they wouldn't let him in on their territory, finally they're allowed in there. Again, things have changed politically by the 19th century. In 1895, there is, in fact, a Coptic Catholic patriarch. Leo XIII erected multiple different seminaries for different churches. One example, in 1882, he erected a seminary for Melkite Catholics in Jerusalem, several other places, several other seminaries in Rome for Eastern Catholics. And then finally, it's under Leo XIII that plans are first hatched for a new congregation, all its own, just for the Eastern churches, the Sacred Congregation for the Eastern Churches, which comes to fruition not under his successor, Pius X, but a couple reigns later, under Benedict XV, from 1914 to 1922, I think he dies. But Benedict XV, famous for his peace overtures during World War One. 1917 with the motu proprio De Providentis. 1917, just at the end of World War One, erects the Sacred Congregation for the Eastern Churches, which again is significant. It means there's an entire body of personnel in the Vatican dedicated to their needs. Can get information from them. Can find out what they want. Can find out, you know, those sorts of things. It means they're being taken seriously. This at the same time, he issues a motu proprio Orientis Catholici, 1917, which sets up the Pontifical Institute for Oriental Studies, or Eastern Christian Studies, I guess it's called today. A fine institution of higher learning, by the way, which is still ongoing, does a lot of good work. I've consulted some of their works for the purposes of this podcast. And again, this is good stuff. Again, does it mean centralization? Does it mean all that stuff? Yes, it does. But it's a good thing for the Eastern Catholics. And a few years later, I think it's 1920. I don't have the document with me, but he basically gives permission for the Pontifical Institute of Oriental Studies to confer doctoral degrees. So again, this is something. Again, a lot of these Eastern churches, again, they're in, you know, whatever their situations are, they may not have access to that type of education. Well, no, they do because of the papacy. So I'm going to toot the papacy's horn for this. They also do something. Benedict XV did this. I found this one here. He did this in 1920, issued an encyclical, Principi Apostolo Petro, in which he names St. Ephrem a universal doctor of the church. He says in the encyclical that this is partly the response, partly due to the request of Eastern Catholic bishops and clergy. It also, by the way, is explicitly the title of the encyclical kind of gives it away. He talks about Saint Ephrem because he was in communion with Rome, being a witness to the authority of Rome, of course. And in fact, this is what this is still. Even though these are overtures to the Orthodox, it's always put in the context of Rome's authority comes first. And in fact, basically every pope I know, at least since Leo XIII, issues an encyclical on an Eastern saint. Leo XIII did one on Saints Cyril and Methodius. Pius X issued one on John Chrysostom. Benedict XV on Ephrem, and also made him a universal doctor of the universal church. I don't know, Pius XII did one on Saint Cyril. They all did this, okay? So it's part of this, both trying to appeal to the East, but while at the same time reasserting its authority. There's some other things. Oh, yeah. Well, Pius XI, one thing about Pius, doesn't do as much. He does issue encyclicals, but in terms of change, one thing he does is that 1938, he issues a motu proprio, I believe, granting jurisdiction over churches in the Middle East to the Congregation for the Eastern Churches, like Syria, Egypt, other parts of the Middle East. And so, again, recognizing it has authority within the Vatican. And then finally, in the reign of Pius XII, I'm only dipping into Pius. There's some other things in Pius XII that are really important, but I'm going to save them for future episodes on specific Eastern Catholic churches. I'm thinking of Russia. One thing he does in terms of, again, institutionalizing the Eastern Catholic churches in Rome is he issues multiple motu propria, and I believe there's talk about this before his reign, about constructing a code of canon law for the Eastern churches, which again is very much a centralizing thing, because it's only in 1917, by the way, that the Roman Catholic Church gets its first universal Catholic law code. Never had it before. You always just had local codes, and I'm guessing the code of Eastern canon law that exists today is, I'm guessing it's universal too. That's also a novelty. But Pius XII, more to the point, issues multiple motu propria on Eastern canon law, 1948, 1950, 1952, 1957. Won't go through all the names and everything. A lot of it having to do with marriage law. He also sets up, by the way, does Pius XII in 1957 or 58, maybe the last year of his life, an exarchate for Byzantine Rite Catholics, I believe Ukrainian, or I can't remember which one, in Britain. So lots of activity on behalf of the Eastern Catholic Churches by the papacy, takes a greater interest. And so to wrap things up, bring this to a close as we get to the last end of this episode, the next ones, 2 points. One, despite initial increased Latinization, and it does happen, and it's still happening. We'll get to, again, we'll get to some stuff with the Byzantine Catholics next time. It's still happening before Vatican II. I think centralization worked in favor of the Eastern Catholic churches in the long run. Yes, I know it made them, you could say it made them more dependent on the Vatican, but it gave them representation there. And as popes became more favorable to their cause and attitudes changed, there's a geopolitical dynamic involved in this as well. This means that they would get more of what they have wanted. And in fact, I think this is what's going to happen after Vatican. This is the second point. I think a lot of what happens after Vatican II, you can say, has its origin in this period. Yes, the ecclesiological aspect was always the sensitive thing with Rome. Its primacy, its jurisdiction, which is weird because you'd think, maybe people complain about it, you'd think infallibility was the big deal. It is, but like it's really the primacy. And and its willingness to recognize that, yeah, okay, there can be local churches that govern themselves and we don't have to sort of govern them ourselves is actually a big, it's a big admission on their part. And they finally do this after Vatican II. And I have to say, again, for all the faults that the centralization brought with it, and it did bring them with it, the Vatican probably gained in this period more knowledge and more accurate knowledge, more to the point, of the Eastern Catholic churches than it ever possessed. And though it always had other motives, right? Part of its motives were to, reunion with the Orthodox, the desire to reassert its authority in the Western world. There are certainly geopolitical considerations involved, and of course there's just ego. And yes, the members of the Vatican hierarchy like their egos, they like power, sure, all those things are true. I do not think you can doubt the sincerity of the popes from Pius IX onward, their sincerity of their good intentions toward the Eastern Catholics, both in the founding of seminaries, institutes in Rome, but also their more permanent interest in the Eastern churches that they represented. So I'm glad to say in a podcast dedicated to controversies that I can say something nice about the Vatican for once, even if there's still problems, and we'll get to those next time. But I think its policies actually are productive in a way they never have been before in the era of, which is still a sort of problematic ecumenism of return. I think the papacy, generally speaking, comes out decently well on this. And that's it for this episode of Controversies in Church History. Next time, upcoming, okay, next episode will be another, I have to get an episode out for my regular listeners. This one will be for patrons first, and then a few weeks later, everybody else. Next episode for everybody will be a little bio on a fascinating figure you should know more about, René Chateaubriand, a French writer, author, apologist, French politician in the early 19th century. Major figure in the history of Romanticism, but also really, really important in the history of apologetics and his life and times next time. And then we'll follow probably the next episode, episode 10 in this long ongoing series on Latinization. Next time, I think I'm going to do the Churches of the Middle East up until Vatican II. In fact, the way it's going to probably go is we'll have the Middle Eastern churches, Melkites, Maronites, Coptic Catholics in the Middle East, Armenians, and then up until Vatican II, basically. Then one on the Church of the East and the Syro-Malabar, the Indian Catholics, and that one up until Vatican II. And then finally, one last one on the Slavic peoples who are in communion with Rome, Byzantine Catholics. That'll deal with several things before Vatican II, most especially Ukrainian Catholics, dealings with Russia. And then finally, after that, one last one on Vatican II and its changes to wrap up and talk about its connection to stuff going on today. So that's, what, four more at least? At least. I might have to have a whole wrap-up episode. So we might have, goodness, 13 or 14 episodes. I'm tired just thinking about it. Anyway, that's what's upcoming on Controversies in Church History. Oh, be on the lookout for more my writing. I have an article out today, actually, I really like this article. Go check it out on Crisis Magazine. It's called Jordan Peterson and the Apocalypse. It's about my experience at the Symbolic World Summit. If you don't know what the Symbolic World is, it's the YouTube channel of Jonathan Pajot, who is a Canadian icon painter, maker, I don't know how to pronounce what the proper term is, but also a sort of cultural figure with his YouTube channel. Great. I'm a member of, subscribe to his channel, member of his little online community that he's formed. I highly recommend it. The article talks about his work, but also what I experienced at this little meeting of him and his followers in Tarpon Springs, Florida. I had a blast there. But go check that out if you haven't already. And tell people about it. Share the article. I appreciate it. Share the article. Share this podcast. Share this episode. Please get the word out about the podcast. If you want to be a patron, that's good. That's fine. And I do not, I'm not going to belabor that. But please share the podcast. Let people know about it. I'd love to have more support and help. It helps. Knowing that I'm doing good work keeps me going. So, and keep me in your prayers as well. As I'll pray for my listeners and patrons. And keep you all in my prayers. Have a wonderful, I forgot to wish you all, guys, a blessed Easter. It's Eastertide. Happy Easter. Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. Christos voskres, voistino voskres. Christos anesti, aletos anesti. Christ is risen. God bless you all. Have a happy Easter season to all of you and to all the Eastern Christians who aren't there yet, if you haven't gotten there yet. Happy upcoming resurrection of Christ to you, that feast. Wonderful, wonderful, blessed feast. And you will hear from me, guys, will hear from me hopefully sooner rather than later. Take care and God bless.